This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Tuesday, the 11th of April, 2006. From the studios of KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, welcome to Walmart Banking. The world's largest retailer moves to become its own bank. Official results from Italy's general election indicate center-left coalition candidate Romano Prodi, the country's next prime minister. And we'll take a look at gender, sexuality, and race in Peru's general election. We'll bring you these stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Sri Lanka is once again witnessing a series of violent incidents on the eve of a new round of peace talks. Pania Monica Vasagam reports from Sri Lanka.
In the wake of recent attacks in the northeastern parts of Sri Lanka, political observers are already voicing skepticism about the peace talks scheduled to begin on April 19th in Geneva. The government said 12 Navy troopers were killed and 8 others were wounded Tuesday in the third Clemmer mine attack in the past few days. Norwegian truth monitors said in a statement, over 20 security personnel were killed in violent attacks over the past 5 days, and many civilians were caught in these incidents, which caused death and serious injuries. The statement condemned the attacks and urged the government and the Tamil Tigers to maintain the ceasefire and not to engage in provocative acts of violence. Lead truth monitor Ulf Hendrickson said, after visiting a scene of explosion, these attacks are seriously jeopardizing not only Geneva talks scheduled for next week, but has a detrimental effect on the ceasefire signed in 2002 between the government and the rebels. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ponnaiah Manikavasagam from Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
In Spain, a judge has handed down indictments to 29 men for their alleged participation in the Madrid train bombings. The attacks killed 191 people on March 11, 2004. Although Al-Qaeda claimed responsibility for the bombings, a 2-year investigation has concluded that an independent Islamist group was behind the attacks on 4 commuter trains. The trial is expected to begin sometime next year. In New York City, the president of the Transport Workers Union has been sentenced to jail for last December's subway strike. Mitch Jezerich reports.
Roger Toussaint, president of Local 100 of the Transport Worker Union, will serve 10 days in jail for calling a subway and bus strike last December in violation of the state's Taylor law that bars public employees from striking. Toussaint responded today on Pacifica station WBAI's wake-up call.
Well, obviously there's no point really to be served by a jail sentence except the need of some in New York to send a message to labor and to the social justice movements that if you stand up, they will crush you. Because they are afraid by the example that our strike set. We were prepared to do whatever sacrifices was required back in December, as we are right now, to stand up for our members and for our union.
Toussaint has 30 days before he must surrender to authorities. Mitch Jezerich reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Workers from a company that outsources to the Buenos Aires Subway Authority went on strike and shut down all 5 of the city's subway lines today. FSRN's Marie Trigona has more from Buenos Aires.
Some 500 subway janitors and security guards from temporary employment agencies are calling for negotiations between the Labor Ministry and Metro Vias, the private company that runs the Buenos Aires subway system. The strikers want to be included in the collective labor contract between formal employees and Metro Vias. The protest began this morning with strikers allowing passengers to ride the subway for free. After the Labor Ministry refused to meet with the janitors and security guards, the workers blocked the subway line. As we go to air, police are standing guard, waiting for the order to evict the workers from the subway tunnel. Dissident subway delegates from an independent, organized labor commission support the outsource employees' demand to be included in the formal contract with a 16% pay raise. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona in Buenos Aires.
At the Enron trial in Houston, Jeff Skilling, former president and CEO, has taken the stand. Lisa Cohen reports from the courthouse.
With the help of his attorney, Dan Petrocelli, Skilling maintains that he left the company in sound financial shape just 3.5 months before it collapsed into bankruptcy in December 2001. This collapse, the defense argues, was brought on by undeserved negative media attention, which undermined market confidence and precipitated a run on the banks. Skilling testified he, quote, wanted to die, unquote, when he saw TV reports of Enron employees moving their belongings out of the building when bankruptcy was announced. Skilling is charged with 28 counts of conspiracy, fraud and insider trading and faces a maximum of 275 years if convicted on all charges. From KPFT in Houston, I'm Lisa Cohen.
President Bush's approval rating has sunk to a new low. According to a new Washington Post ABC News poll, 60% of those polled disapprove of the way in which Bush handles his job as president. Those surveyed showed the strongest disapproval of the situation in Iraq, gas prices, and health care. Over the weekend, more than 100 Vermont Democratic leaders passed a resolution urging Congress to begin immediate proceedings for the impeachment of President George W. Bush. Renee Carpenter reports.
Members of the Vermont Democratic Committee met to discuss President Bush's impeachment using Section 603 of Jefferson's Manual, a parliamentary procedure that allows both houses of any state legislature to begin impeachment proceedings in Congress. This special meeting of Vermont Democratic Committee members was called after several county committees called for Bush's impeachment. Seven towns in Vermont passed similar resolutions. While the language varies, they all refer to allegations of lying to Congress and the American people to justify the war in Iraq and to the NSA's domestic surveillance program. During the three-hour debate, an amendment by Ann Lazak of Rutland County inserted language similar to Wisconsin's recent impeachment resolution. This directs the Vermont resolution to Congress, bypassing the Vermont legislature, and directs Congress to begin impeachment proceedings. Vermont joins five other states sending impeachment resolutions to Congress. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Renee Carpenter in Plainfield, Vermont.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Official results from Italy's general election declared center-left coalition candidate Romano Prodi as the country's next prime minister. FSRN Siletta Varlesi reports from Italy, where current PM Silvio Berlusconi is refusing to concede defeat.
Italy went to bed yesterday with no idea of who was going to be next government. Indeed, last night, the distance between Prodi and Berlusconi by just 0.2 percentage point. But by morning, Prodi's coalition, the Union, was declared the winner. Thanks to votes coming from Italian citizens living abroad, Prodi's coalition won a majority of seats in both the upper and lower houses of parliament, and the winners are allotted 340 of 640 parliament seats under new Italian election rules. Voter returns, however, left Italians with the image of a country divided exactly in two. Prodi remained optimistic and released this declaration after official votes were released.
Dear friends, we won.
Cari amici, cari amiche, abbiamo vinto.
We won, and now we have to start to work together to unite this country that, as shown by the elections, is a country deeply divided. We have to work hard to change Italy and make it grow again. Today is a new day. It has been a very difficult battle, but in the end, victory came.
Ma alla fine la vittoria è arrivata.
One of the problems that this new government could face is the lack of stability. When asked if this government would hold up over the next 5 years, Prodi answered this way.
The situation in the country is complex and difficult, and we'll have to all work together with the Italians that did not vote for us. We need a government that can work for everybody, and we'll have to suture the rupture existing in the country.
Berlusconi's coalition, the House of Freedom, or CDL, including neo-fascists and any immigrant parties, say they think that about 45,000 votes are incorrect and must be reviewed. Until that happens, Berlusconi refused to recognize the election as valid.
There are relevant differences that are very strange, and we want them to be verified. We consider these results as not valid.
The tension for voters did not subside by the second day. Members of each camp say they feel nervous about what will happen. Center-left voters Michele Serra.
With this small majority, I'm afraid the administration will be complicated. If a senator gets sick, we could end up in chaos in the parliament.
Marco Guidi voted with the center-right coalition.
I'm very surprised because I expected a big defeat for center-right because of surveys and also by the vulgar attitude of the former prime minister at the end of the political campaign. By the way, it seems to have worked well by the results.
The U.S. expressed its congratulations for the next Italian government, confirming their intention to cooperate with Italy. Mr. Ciampi, president of Italian Republic, greeted the results as official definitive. For Free Speech Radio News, Diletta Varlese, Italy.
Over 16 million voters headed to the polls Sunday in Peru's national presidential and parliamentary elections. Former military colonel and nationalist candidate Ollanta Humala leads in the popular vote, while Congresswoman Lourdes Flores and former Peruvian president Alan Garcia are tied and vying for the second place spot. Only the top two candidates will go to the runoff round of elections. FSRN's Cristi Lipuma Herrera reports on the role of gender, sexuality, and race in this election.
Lawyer and former Congresswoman Lourdes Flores of the business-friendly National Unity Alliance has received much attention as a female candidate for president. Jessica, a 25-year-old mother of three who also works as an assistant cook in a restaurant, says that with a history of so many male politicians' empty promises for Peruvians, she hopes Lourdes Flores will come through for her.
What? The prices just keep going up. The rice, the sugar, the bread, and the salaries, they stay the same. Minimum wage, $110, $120 a month. Tell me something. We work. I work from 7 in the morning to 5 in the evening and earn $3 a day. And that $3 you spend on one meal. Our children need fruit, food, and $3 doesn't cover that. You go to the market and a kilo of rice costs 75 cents, a kilo of sugar 95 cents, bread 7-8 cents a piece. $3 isn't enough. It isn't fair. We need a woman leader here in Peru. We women, we know what we need in our homes. And it would be good to finally elect a woman.
Hanna Villazan is a trans woman and an independent activist running for a seat in the Andean Parliament, which includes Peru, Colombia, Ecuador, Venezuela, and Bolivia. She's wary of trusting Flores' commitment to the economic predicaments of women in Jessica's situation.
Being a woman doesn't exempt you from discriminating, from having prejudices, from being a dictator, from being a tyrant, and that's something to keep in mind. I think if you talk to a woman from a working-class neighborhood who knows what it's like to have kids and make $3 a day and go to the market and make dinner and live many sacrifices to help her kids, that's someone who can talk about the conditions of working women.
Villazan is running on the Socialist Party ticket, which has also criticized Flores' lack of commitment to anti-discrimination legislation.
I think that the fact that she thinks of homosexuality as an illness puts her on the conservative Catholic side, which one could clearly say that she belongs to. Another thing they asked her was if she would put a law into effect for civil unions or homosexual marriages. And she said that marriage is between a man and a woman. That could be from the religious standpoint, but I think that in the legal realm, people need to have the same rights.
The leading candidate, Ollanta Humala, in addition to Flores, has been heavily criticized in nonprofit and activist circles for not condemning his mother's recent violent homophobic comments to the press. But some say he's been singled out and smeared by a media that favors the powerful. Most upper and middle class Peruvians have expressed fear for Humala, who has garnered widespread support from Peru's poor and working classes, with his calls for an economic revolution that redistributes the country's wealth, and also for his call to destroy deeply entrenched racial inequalities in Peru.
We can see that this is a candidate who has a good chance of taking the lead. He also represents a change in the neoliberal economic model and butts heads with a lot of powerful interests. So they've taken it upon themselves to destroy him.
Sergio recently graduated in sociology from a prestigious university in Lima. He says the majority of his well-off classmates want a leftist president, but they're unwilling to take the plunge with Humala, whose talk of a non-white Peruvian uprising is seen as too radical by many intellectuals.
People should stop being scared of this popular option. Above all, the middle class, who right now are playing the role of maintaining the status quo of the system, I hope this changes and that people can realize that this is not a fascist nationalism as we've seen in Europe. It's an integrated nationalism that comes out of the pueblos, from the marginalized.
For Free Speech Radio News in Lima, Peru, this is Cristi Lipuma Herrera.
Congress may wait until next January after midterm elections to pass a landmark nuclear deal between the U.S. and India. President Bush's recent support for India purchasing foreign nuclear technology without first signing the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty has sent a mixed message to the Iranian government. As Iranian affairs correspondent Saida Jamshidi reports, the favoritism shown to India is making Iranians more skeptical about U.S. policy in the region.
U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice's effort to make Congress ratify the Indian civil nuclear technology has paid off, and she got the deal. In return, India will declassify 14 of its 22 nuclear facilities for full international inspections. Although this may seem a fair deal, India preserved the right to build nuclear weapons since India is not a signatory of the Non-Proliferation Treaty or NPT. This favor by the U.S. makes Iran wary about America's interest in the region. Iran signed the NPT and claims that its nuclear program is peaceful.
There is Iran's opposition to the state of Israel, which is very offensive to many people in the American administration and in the American public at large.
Dr. Thomas Metayer is the consultant to the government and businesses in Washington, D.C.
Even if Iran claims that the program is peaceful, and even if Iran appears to be many years away from mastering the technology and assembling the equipment, the very prospect of an Iranian nuclear weapon would indicate that Iran would have a greater capability to influence events in the Persian in the entire Middle East, a greater ability to pressure Israel, a greater ability to pressure Saudi Arabia, greater ability to pressure any new government in Iran.
Iran's new conservative government is portrayed as a growing threat in the Middle East. But some experts, such as Mustafa Malik, who is a Washington journalist, researcher, and specialist in Middle Eastern affairs, believe the whole negotiation about nuclear power in the region is not really Iran's issue. Everything relates to preserving Israel's nuclear monopoly in the Middle East.
Iran, even if Iran has 5 or 10 nuclear bombs tomorrow, they are not going to commit a national suicide by attacking Israel or let alone the United States. What the Americans are concerned is that Israel's nuclear monopoly will be over. Israel has now between 200 and 500 nuclear bombs. And if Israel does not have a nuclear monopoly in the Middle East, it cannot treat the Palestinians the way they are treating.
Several countries like Egypt, Jordan, and other countries in the Persian Gulf are concerned about Israel's nuclear power and the level of power it holds. According to Malik, there is a race over having a nuclear power.
So because America had, Russians felt the need to have nuclear weapons. Because Russians had it, Chinese felt the need to have. And because Chinese had it, Indians had. And because Indians had it, Pakistan had. So similarly, it is in the Middle East now. Israel has nuclear weapons. It is an incentive for the Iranians to have nuclear weapons, although they say they don't want to have it, and I don't know whether they do. But if Iranians have it, the Saudis, Egyptians may want to have them too.
Negotiation over nuclear power in the Middle East has become more intense in recent years. Iran is devoted to pursue their right to build a nuclear energy, but they have been unsatisfied to design a trustful relationship with the United States. On the other hand, the tension over U.S. policy in the Middle East has escalated since the Iraq War. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Saida Jamshidi.
Walmart is following procedure with hopes of becoming its own bank. The world's largest retailer says they will save money by cutting out third-party banking fees, thus reducing costs for consumers. But opponents say it sets a bad precedent for commerce and would ignore its banking responsibilities to low- and middle-income communities. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
The FDIC held a public hearing on Walmart's application to become an industrial loan company, or ILC. ILCs are a type of bank. They are state-chartered companies with vast banking authority and are insured by the FDIC. Walmart says they want to perform the services of submitting payments made by credit cards, debit cards, and electronic check transactions made by consumers. In a written testimony, President of Walmart Financial Services, Jane Thompson, said that a Walmart bank would increase efficiency and effectiveness. She also said that Walmart would receive the fees that Walmart usually pays for these services and that the cost savings would be passed on to their customers. Randall Dodd is with the Economic Policy Institute.
Let me just say that I think that whereas this is a bad policy of having industrial loan banks, extending it to Walmart would be a further mistake.
Groups and organizations opposed to Walmart acquiring industrial loan bank status include community banks, the AFL-CIO, the National Grocers Association, local business alliances, and community development organizations, just to name a few. Reasons for their opposition vary. Some say they won't adhere to banking responsibilities of providing banking opportunities to low-income communities. They base that not only on Walmart's record of low wages and lack of benefits for employees, but on an initial ignorance of the Community Reinvestment Act and its application process. That act ensures that banking entities reinvest in the community. And although Walmart maintains that their banking operations will be limited, opponents say this is a foot in the door. Walmart will be able to expand its banking services to be consumer-oriented and in turn will affect the business of other local banks. And Walmart's application has raised attention on the larger policy debate behind ILCs.
The FDIC should nevertheless reject the application because it violates a purported national policy that commerce should be separated from banking.
Peter Wallison is a researcher at the American Enterprise Institute speaking on his own behalf. Critics such as Wallison say the FDIC should not rule on Walmart's application because Congress has not yet set a clear policy on the connection between commerce and banking.
If there ever was such a policy, it was abandoned when Congress adopted the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act in 1999.
In 1999, Congress liberalized the standards of what types of companies can become an ILC. When a consumer corporation such as Walmart becomes one, they are subject to less regulation, but still they are federally insured, which places the burden on the taxpayer if the bank goes broke. General Motors, Toyota, and Target are all ILCs, but critics say that Walmart, making more than $200 billion last year, is so large that it will undermine any U.S. banking structure. Again, Randall Dodd.
By extending this charter to Walmart, we're going to extend the scope and potentially extend the scale and potentially the scope of this type of loophole. And I think that'd be a very bad national policy at a time when the stability of our financial system is really critical for economic performance.
But Lawrence White, professor of economics at NYU, said that Walmart should receive banking status if standards are in place.
Any party that is financially capable, that has a sound business plan, and is of good character, should be allowed to own a bank, so long as the bank itself is adequately capitalized and competently managed and restricted to examinable and supervisable activities. And again, it's important to stress the monitoring of all financial transactions between the owner and the bank, so as to reduce and hopefully eliminate the opportunities for draining money out of the bank.
The House of Representatives has passed two bills that would further liberalize ILCs, but the Senate has yet to take them up because it is so controversial. The FDIC will hold another hearing on this in Kansas at the end of April. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Women in Nepal have long been deprived of fundamental socioeconomic rights. In 1963, the civil code allowed husbands to divorce infertile wives, yet women had no right to divorce their impotent husbands. But last month, the Supreme Court annulled that law. PCW reports from Kathmandu, where some say more radical measures like the March 30 judgment are needed to ameliorate the plight of women in Nepalese society governed by the rules of patriarchy.
On March 30, Nepal's Supreme Court spiked a 43-year-old anti-woman law that allowed men to seek divorce on the ground of their spouse's infertility. The Civil Code of 1963 had the provision offering a man the privilege to seek divorce if a government-recognized medical board affirmed his wife's inability to conceive after 10 years of marriage. A group of women human rights activists had filed a writ in the Nepalese apex court last year seeking its abrogation. The irony was that this law did not allow women to seek divorce on the ground of their husband's impotency. Women and human rights activists in Nepal are hailing it as a revolutionary judgment, which would win great dignity and equality for women. Meena Ghimire, a lawyer specializing in women issues, considers the apex court verdict as a landmark victory in the fight to end traditional discrimination against women embedded in the Hindu patriarchal social culture of the country. But she feels much more needs to be done to ensure positive gender equality.
Both our Nepalese Hindu society and psyche are traditionally anti-women programmed. We need to thoroughly reprogram them, inculcating the notion that men and women are divinely equal and symbiotic. Certainly, this verdict will provide a push for it, because laws have punitive ingredients to prevent disobedience.
But Mohan Pathak, a Hindu religion scholar, denies that the anomaly of divorce on the ground of a woman's infertility is due to the Hindu culture.
Actually, the very concept of divorce is alien to our Hindu religion. However, in case of infertility of the first wife, a husband can marry another woman with the consent of the first one. It does not at all mean that the first wife has to be divorced. The 1963 civil code is not a Hindu code. So it is wrong to say that such anti-woman legal provision is a Hindu phenomenon.
No matter what anyone argues, it is an axiom that the ex-divorce provision has come as a boon for many infertile women whose husbands could be scheming to elbow them out of their homes. But the court did not offer relief to the several hundred women victims of the 1963 law. Such victims, mainly those who got divorced before 2002, lead miserable lives. Till then, the women divorced on the ground of infertility for 10 years had no right to any share in their husband's property. They could claim foodstuff only for 5 years after the divorce. They could not even return to their parents' houses, as a Nepalese woman loses right to her parental property after marriage.
Both infertile women were often forced into prostitution. Some volunteer groups did help them, but charity is never a substitute for rights. In 2002, the law was amended giving divorced women right to equal share in husband's property, but they rarely reap the right because of legal illiteracy. Besides, the inbuilt wins of our male-dominated society are big hurdles.
Despite this revolutionary judgment and some positive past legislations, women still face a host of legal and social discriminations. The worst is that children born to women not in a legitimate marriage are denied the right to citizenship. Children born of rapes, polygamy, prostitution, and illicit relations are denied citizenship even if they have mothers with Nepalese citizenship. Neeraj Pandey, a youth social activist, has called for a multifaceted fight against such injustice.
Some 1.1 million Nepalese are stateless persons in their own country. Their fault is that their mothers don't have legitimate Nepalese husbands.
This anomaly has cropped up because marriages are rarely registered in Nepal. Polygamy is common. Men marry and desert women at will and with impunity. Polygamy is technically illegal, but its illegality remains a paper tiger. Children born from a polygamous marriage, particularly in the case of deserted women, have no right to citizenship. And deserted women can't claim any right to their husband's property because they have no proof of marriage. Again, Neeraj Pandey.
The remedy lies in winning gender equality regarding social, legal and property rights through writs in Supreme Court, which has indeed a tilt for women. Even it is must to promote education and awareness among rural and semi-urban women who are most vulnerable. Besides fighting individual cases of women victims through court, media, parliament and even protest marches would also build the bridges of gender inequality and discrimination.
From Kathmandu, I am PC Dubey for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Pogado.